Set down your sleepy water and your Mr. Whistle. Take off that raincoat and grab a cold beer. It's time to have a real talk about pediatric dentistry. You're listening to Bruise and Tiny Teeth, the unfiltered pediatric dentistry podcast.
What's up, Bruise and Tiny Teeth fam? It's your boy Casey Getz checking in. Today's episode, we have Dr. Bobby Thakurasi. He is a really well-known, renowned speaker. Most of us that got out of residency in the last couple of years probably listened to him speak at one of the sedation courses that the AAPD hosts. He's really well-known on that lecture circuit, and he's just a great guy to talk to. He's really easy to converse with and just a really sharp guy. I liked how practical he was. I complimented him that as an academic, I was impressed at how often he related the struggles or the issues with oral sedation to being a private practice owner, which was, I thought, kind of a unique thing. But just a really cool guy, great guy to talk to. And we got to talk a little bit about oral sedation since he's kind of the sedation expert. That's a conversation that I don't have as much on the podcast since I don't do as many oral conscious sedations, but I know a lot of listeners and a lot of pediatric dentists out there still keep that modality in their back pocket. And that's kind of what we talk about today is providing that service for kids that fall in between the spectrum of, you know, you can do SDF and Hall crowns, and then you can go all the way to general anesthesia. But what do you do for those kids in the middle that, you know, need a little bit of extra TLC there? And so we have a great conversation on that. So Dr. Bobby had a beer with me. I hope you guys join me. So crack a cold one, enjoy the episode, and cheers.
Cincinnati Brew.
Okay. Well, I just hit the record button. So let's crack them together. Cause I grabbed a Sam Adams Winter Lager. I'm trying to clean up some Christmas beers. So
okay,
I'll crack it open with you.
Okay. This is a Rheingeist Bubbles, which is, it's like 6%, I think, alcohol. So it's heavy, but it's a blood orange. So I haven't tried the blood orange yet.
Oh, okay, cool. And that's a local, like a Cincinnati brewery somewhere out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. Bobby, are you, we didn't get a chance to catch up much here, but are you originally from the Cincinnati area? I know that's where you're at and practicing and doing academics, but are you from that area?
No, I'm actually from Southern California. That's where I grew up, went to undergrad, everything there. And then when it came time to apply to dental school, I just wanted to get out of California. So I went to New York and did dental school at NYU. And in the end of my dental school, I applied through the Air Force. So I did, I did about 8 years in the Air Force. And that is really what brought me back to Ohio. And, we just fell in love with it. It's literally, I could drive 20 minutes from here and be in the country, be in the, you know, downtown city. And so there's just, it's just a lot going on. Good art scene, good food scene, and no traffic. That's the big thing, difference between California and here. No traffic.
No traffic. You know, I've never had a full-time military pediatric dentist on the podcast. Part of the reason being is they're pretty restrictive about what they can talk about. I think there's just a lot of red tape behind it because I've asked. But I reflect on that time. 8 years is a pretty good chunk of time in the Air Force. I've had a couple guys on that did a few military stints to pay back loans and stuff. But most people say that the experience they get is, I don't know if priceless is the word, but it sounds like you get some reps and you get to see a lot of interesting stuff when you're a military doc, it sounds like.
Yeah, my whole family, we really loved it. So the advantage for me is I did an AGD out of dental school. And then for 2 years, I was a general dentist in the Air Force in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So it's a part of the country we never would have gone to. And, it's just, it's beautiful. I mean, we talked about retiring in Cheyenne. It's just gorgeous. And then after my pediatric training, we did 3 years in Germany. And that was, again, wonderful. We were right in the middle of Europe, and this was in a very different era from now. So traveling was really great. And for me, it was, my office, we called it the bullpen. My office was with the periodontist, oral surgeon, endodontist, you know, so we all kind of talked to each other, and that was right after I got out of dental, I'm a pediatric training. So it really helped me build my confidence and build my speed as a clinician. Because when you come right out of residency, you're still, you know, you're still kind of finding your feet.
You know, it's, it was, is it 20 years if you do in the military, then you get like a full military pension. You almost got halfway there. That's a pretty good chunk of time.
Yeah. And it was at that point where, we were like halfway. So I was being, you know, being asked to recommit. And at that time, one of my faculty from when my pediatric training, he called me and he said, we have a job. This was at Ohio State University. He said, we have a job, faculty position opening. Would you like to come interview? And honestly, the only downside in the military for us was that we had to move every 3 years. And so we just didn't like that as much. So we, that's where I went into academics, basically.
Gotcha.
But what, yeah, what we year, were what? Close and, other than the moving, we loved everything about it, you know?
That's cool. That's cool. What year was it then that you made the switch from the military to the academic life? How long ago was that?
So that was 2006.
Oh, snap. So, okay. So you've been, gosh, you're going to be
18.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was life like 2006? So you made the transition, moved to Ohio and got into academics. You know, I haven't had a lot of academic conversation on the podcast, which was a goal of today a little bit too, but what were the, you know, were you able to hit the ground running? What kind of shoes were you playing there?
Yeah. My mentors at Ohio State, Denny McTeague, Paul Casamassimo, Steve Wilson, these are also big names in our field, and they kind of, they embraced me and hit the ground running, and I ran the pre-doc, so the dental student part of the pedo program, and that's something I really enjoyed, is working with dental students. Probably if there's one thing I miss here at Cincinnati, because we don't have a dental school, is the working with dental students. The trade-off is we have an AAGD program, and they are pretty involved with us from University of Cincinnati. So that is fulfilling as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So right now what's your current role? Cause I don't know where there's residency programs and what the academic situation looks like out there. Is there, you guys have a residency program with a certain amount of residents?
Yes. So I'm currently the division chair, and we have a residency program, and we have 12 residents. We're going up to 13. So we take 6 a year. This year we're taking 7. So in a couple of years we'll have 14. And they come from all over the country, which is really interesting, and it's fun for me. I've always said that when I retire, I'd like to just get an RV and we take a little cross-country trip, and I stop at every resident that I've been able to train along the way. So they're, all over the country from coast to coast, north to south. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, some of the names you rattled off, I graduated from Iowa. I'm an Iowa guy, but you know, you know, like Casamassino, a lot of these same guys that you just rattled off, you go look at I just thought of this the other day, cause my stack of scrubs, when I change into scrubs, sits right next to all my textbooks that I keep in the office. And that big, you know, infancy through adolescence textbook, it's Nowak and Casamassino. It's all these like OG authors that wrote the textbook. And a lot of them have, you know, Iowa, but Cincinnati, you see a lot of Cincinnati background too.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Iowa was really kind of our generation, is really a lot of educators came out of Iowa. And so, Iowa's always been a great program. I've been able to go there. I have friends there, and, I love it out there at the University of the Dental School.
You made a a point that I'll just kind of ask about while you're on it, but you know, you were just had said that, you know, you, from a different generation, and that's to your point, you know, some of the old timers that maybe aren't around anymore in a practice philosophy that's not as common, you're seeing a bit of a lost art there. But what was the field like when you started? I'm kind of curious to see what the difference is between when you were teaching and the residents in the 2006, 2007, 2008, compared to 18 years later. And the obvious ones, you know, were minimally invasive and things like that. But, you know, just kind of big picture stuff. What, you know, do you miss those days, or what kind of changes have you been seeing?
Well, I think that as you move from, you know, the 90s into now, the big, one of the biggest changes has been the amount of kind of regulation on our specialty. And I think we've only seen the role of insurance companies increase. I mean, I know when I think back, this is before me, but, you know, going to general anesthesia was a significant thing. I mean, you would, child would be admitted, they'd have chest x-ray, they'd have labs drawn. It was a definite, a huge undertaking. Whereas now we tend to think of GA so commonplace. Also, because I think that if you look, the ages of the kids that we're seeing all these problems in has gotten so much younger. So I think that those are significant, and those are part of the reasons these non-invasive, you know, Hall crowns, SDF, those have come into play, is the nature of who we're seeing has really changed. And if you look historically, like in the literature, while the overall incidence of dental caries in the U.S. population is decreasing, really what's happening is the burden is shifting to that 0 to 5 group. And that's the group where we are seeing like really destructive effects of poor oral health.
Mm-hmm. And to your point, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I always talk to parents about is not just that, but also being isolated to certain very specific, you know, demographic, you know, it's like underserved, rural, lower socioeconomic status, immigrants, you know, it's kind of like, it seems like the caries rates have not, you know, my understanding is not really decreased as much as we would like in those certain populations. Right. So like,
I mean, exactly. I think in those other, you know, kind of subgroups, ethnic minorities, economically challenged, we've seen an increase, because aside from all that, and I'm sure you see this every day, is culturally we've changed as a nation. So if I look at the 1980s, which is really the heyday of my childhood, and then I look at now, I mean, it's dramatically different. And I mean, I remember as a kid, and I think that's one of the things, is I'm finding myself starting to tell the residents, I remember when, you know, and I'm starting to use that kind of preface, but, you know, we would go out to play, and I mean, honestly, my parents had no clue where I was most of the time. And as long as I was home by the time the streetlights came on, that was fine. Whereas, you know, my son growing up, and he's 22 now, but when he was growing up, we never would have thought of just letting him go off. So I think culturally we changed, our diets have changed, what we eat is changing. So we do see a lot of that. And when I was in training, we had just as a specialty stopped hand over mouth, which used to be a much more common behavior technique. And it was probably my first year of residency that the AEPD kind of took that out of the guidelines. So I've only heard about that historically. I've never used it myself or anything like that. But folks who used it said it was a really good technique when it was used effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. You never really hear anybody say it didn't work. You know, you just hear people say that, you know, it's barbaric and I'm glad it's gone. But very few anybody, to your point, a lot of people are like, no, it worked. And it was a different, a different style of kid. You know, I'll piggyback off of that because I just had this conversation a while ago. But even like I was fortunate enough to shadow a few pediatric dentists who really had old school guys that had mastered that art of like voice control, you know, using that dad voice that I call it. And I've seen it used really, really effectively. And so I've tried it and I'm not great at it by any means, but I feel like kids don't even respond. Like it, to your point, a cultural shift to a point where like so many kids don't even respond where they just, they don't have any, like they just shut down. Like if you're going to be stern with them, tell them no. If you're going to, you know, use voice control, it almost, I feel like kids now, it doesn't have the same effect on the same subset of kids it did 20 years ago, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I use it rarely. And it's probably more traumatic for me than it is for the kid. I mean, right. I have to like summon the tiger to like be able to do that. and it's just, you're absolutely right, which is there's so much overstimulation of kids in general that these techniques, you have to find a different way to use them. Mm-hmm. And I think also, you know, I'll say another challenge, I think, for private practitioners. You know, I'm in an academic center in a big children's hospital. And I don't have to, I'm not as much at the whim of parents as I feel my residents who are in private practice feel they are. Social media as a parental presence is not something that I trained with, you know, having, if a parent is unhappy, they're not only going to tell you, they're going to go and post about it. And that influences your ability in the community. So it's a very different environment that our graduates now practice in, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let's, you know, kind of shifting gears on that while we're kind of on that subject of some behavior management. You know, I know that when your name gets brought up and colleagues that I've talked to, you know, I talked to about you coming on the podcast, your name has become a bit synonymous with like sedation training, anesthetic techniques. And I'm pretty sure, maybe when I was a resident, we did a sedation course, maybe in San Diego or Vegas or somewhere out there. And I'm fairly certain I had you as a lecturer. And I believe you lecture with Steve Wilson quite a bit as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's one of my primary mentors, and he has taught me a lot just about behavior throughout my career. And I think I've been fortunate to be able to kind of expand on that because I had good mentorship as a younger academic.
Mm-hmm. So walk me back then, you know, the way that you got into sedation. I don't know, we didn't talk about how many sedations you were doing when you were in the service, but did you really shift gears and start doing more sedation, more oral sedation? Like, what does your sedation history kind of look like, starting from maybe once you got into the academic life?
Sure. So in the military, so coming out of training, I had a good background doing oral sedation. And then in the military, I was able to kind of build my schedule. So I was fortunate that it was me. I had three assistants and I had two rooms. So I was able to build my schedule and pretty much everyone left me alone because I was treating the patients that nobody else wanted to treat, namely the kids. So I was able to basically keep my experience. So I would do two sedations every week. And so I never lost that touch about it. As I got into academics, really what I began to learn more is the different medications. And so the different regimens and the different types of combinations. And a lot of that has come from having residents who say, hey, I'm going to this practice, this is what they use, I'd really like to get good at that. And so my job is really knowing how to train someone for the process of sedation. And I think that's where I've really changed over the course of my career. So when I started, I trained very specifically to medications. But then as I've, I guess, evolved and grown, really, it's just a process that is independent of the medications. So that when I train residents, I try to teach them how to assess a child, how to dose a child, how to rescue a child, irrespective of what the medications are. Just because I think we don't know what we're going to get when we give a child a medication. Some kids, you give them half the dose you think, and they are completely out. Other kids, you give them everything. You throw everything at the kitchen sink at them, and they do not get anywhere near sedated. I think another big change for me has been with general anesthesia becoming so prevalent. And we're really fortunate in Cincinnati, we have in-office general anesthesia within our clinic, which are the kids that used to be the deep sedations. So the kids that used to be chloral hydrate are now getting in-office general anesthesia. So I have the luxury of being able to teach residents to abort a sedation if they cannot get the work done safely and effectively.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's an interesting point you just brought up, that, you know, the kids that used to be deeper sedations because of the ease of access and access to care, like we're shifting those kids to in-office GA, which I am, just as a info for you, I come from a point of my office, I have a really good, I have an anesthesiologist that comes out. We do nasal intubated in-office GA, and I'm spoiled. So I'm very self-aware of that. But, you know, it kind of gets me thinking, and there's a lot of offices going that direction, as you know. So I am, though, aware and would like your thoughts that I feel like there's a subset of kids that are kind of getting lost, like right in the middle in that sweet spot. You got the screaming obvious kids that, like, yeah, this kid is a general anesthesia kid all day long. And then you got the kids that it's like, okay, they're cooperative, or, you know, you can get it done. Like, maybe we'll just pick out the two big cavities. We'll do a couple hall crowns, put some SDF on the small ones. But there's a lot of kids that fall in that little gap. And those are the kids that I sometimes feel guilty on, where it's like, damn, you know, this kid's got, you know, two or three things. It's either going to be a lot of like tough fitting hall crowns, back-to-back hall crowns, which, you know, maybe there's space loss, or maybe there's just one bad quadrant. So you're either really aggressive taking them to general anesthesia or setting them up. And those are the kids that, as this becomes a bit of a somewhat of an art that not as many of us are efficient at, those are the kids that maybe, you know, lose the best option that we could be providing for them.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I think one of the things I've really come to appreciate is that as a specialty, pediatric dentists, we are very specially built to really try and use our psychology training to make things easier for kids. I guarantee you that our medical colleagues have no problem going to GA, and they will go to GA for the most minor procedure. And I think the difference is there is an infrastructure that they get paid no matter what they do. And we are struggling to get full reimbursement taking some kids to GA. So like the kid you talk about, this kid who has like two or three teeth and that's it. You know, there's a good chance that insurance would not cover them going to GA. So now the parent is faced with this potentially, you know, $5,000 bill or whatever it is, including anesthesia. So parents are in some cases more willing to say, well, let's do oral sedation. Hopefully they won't remember because I can't afford to go to GA. And those are the kids, you're absolutely right. The most challenging kids are what we call like the CHIP kids, where they have insurance, but they are not quote unquote financially poor enough to be Medicaid, but it is still a significant impact to that family. So And I think that's where private practitioners, and I've talked to many who do payment plans and things like that, and parents respond to that because they want to do what's best for the kid, but they can't always afford that. So I think part of the difference there is physicians probably do not struggle internally with going to GA as much as dentists do.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I also would compliment you. You do a nice job being, you know, labeling you a bit of as an academic guy. I'm impressed at how often you keep like bringing up the very real realities that the majority of us as private practitioners face, which a lot of academics, I feel like, tend to be out of touch with. So I'm impressed. I like that you bring this up. Like, no, these are the actual reasons why like oral contraception is still important to do because of these real life barriers. So I appreciate that you bring that up because for the, thus in private yeah. practice, like these are the issues that we're facing.
Well, and I'll tell you that when I I've lectured now, you know, all over internationally, all over the country. And I think for me, the real benefit is I hear these stories from private practitioners. So it resonates with me because I see the struggles. I mean, I totally understand that the thought that in academics you could be disconnected. But I get to hear all these stories either through the AAPD course or when I lecture across the country. And I'll tell you, in the beginning, I was kind of like shocked at these challenges. And now I'm getting to that point, maybe it's my age, where nothing is shocking me as much anymore. Because, you know, private practitioners have to kind of really do a song and dance. And you are spinning a lot of plates, I feel. So I think another reason I went into academics, I don't think I'd be a good private practitioner. I think I would give away the shop. I think I would just say, yeah, no, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it, which I think a lot of people do. But then at the end of the day, you've got to pay your staff and you've got to, I think I remember, and I also learned this from a lot of my residents as they go into private practice. You know, you pay yourself last, right? You got to keep the lights on. You've got to pay your staff. But then at the very end of it is when you pay yourself. And we were talking about Jake, one of my residents in the Illinois area. And that's what he's going through right now. It's a busy practice. He's got tons of kids. Financially, it's a challenge in the beginning to make it really worth your while. So you have to have a vision and you have to really stick with it.
Mm-hmm. I wrote down something that I was going to comment that you had said earlier, but you know how you had said you get these parents, the chip kids that you never quite know how they're going to do. I had this thought to myself, you know, we have an MD anesthesiologist come in and we pre-med the kids. So, you know, I'll shout out when I'm about 10 minutes out, I'll say, let's go ahead and pre-med the next one. And they do like a, I don't know, like 0.5 per of Versed or something, you know, give the kid a little cocktail to kind of calm him down before taking him back and then doing a SIVO mask down is how we do it. But there's occasionally times, you know, I feel like pretty good with my treatment planning, but once in a while we'll get a kid where, you know, say the 6-year-old that's got some stuff going on, they give him the Versed. And then when the kid comes back and they're masking him down, the kid's goofy and giggly and sitting there and being, you know, masked down great. And I'm just like, damn it. Like this kid was an F2 for me in the chair comp exam day. I'm like, you know, about 1 out of 10 of those, I'm like, yeah, but probably could have gotten it done if I had a way to give this kid a little Versed, I bet. And so, you know, but not all the time. And it's a probability thing. You never know. But there's times I'm like, gosh, son of a bitch, I could have tried, you know,
yeah,
could have tried.
No, something. You're absolutely right. And we get this where, and even the opposite, where the kid is fantastic in hygiene and they get x-rays and they're really good and they have a lot of work, but... And today I had one of my residents come up and I was really proud of him because he said, you know, it was like 4 quadrants of work. Kid was really good. They got x-rays and it was a younger kid. It was a 4-year-old. And so the temptation is you're going to go to GA, especially when you have access. And he said, you know, I'm worried that if I send him straight to GA, it's going to take away the ability for him to surprise us. And I appreciate that attitude because it is so easy to go to GA for everything, you know? But at the end of the day, we are, as pediatric dentists, we our best work is done getting that nervous kid or that, like you said, the goofy kid, and just being able to talk them through something. I mean, that's where I, when I look at my colleagues, I'm so impressed at how, what they're able to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Just to leave a little time for just some, you know, for the, some specifics on some oral conscious sedation techniques.
Yeah.
You know, cause we could talk for hours on this, so I'm trying to just keep it fun and casual and big picture.
Yeah. But yeah.
There's probably a handful of guys out there, guys and girls listening, that still do a fair amount of oral conscious sedation, and it's a big part of their practice. So, you know, maybe I've got a couple questions, but maybe first one being, maybe speak high level, like, you know, everybody's got a kind of got their regimen, their cocktail, their double, triple cocktail that they kind of like. So maybe from a big picture standpoint, what are kind of the drugs you find that you're using more and more of? Now that maybe like chlorhydrate's hard to get a hold of, or are you using that more? Are you doing more intranasal stuff? Like what kind of modalities are you kind of playing with these days?
So for in our hospital, and this has happened a few places, we also lost Demerol. And it was not for any bad reactions, but Demerol was taken off the formulary by the emergency department. So, and there's a push in the medical literature to use morphine instead of Demerol. Morphine has a shorter half-life, but it has a quicker onset. So it's we've been using that for about 3 years now. We shifted completely from Demerol to morphine. So our combos, so when we do a triple combo now, it is typically Versed, morphine, and hydroxyzine. Or for our older kids, we might use Valium, morphine, and hydroxyzine. One of my residents who graduated probably about 10 years ago, and he is a pharmacist, Scott Papineau, who's in Indianapolis, he really introduced me to Valium as a pediatric sedative. It takes a little bit longer to act. There is more of a chance of kind of rebound. So you typically might have to keep the kids longer. But what I have found is sometimes Versed is like an on-off switch. It's either really good or it's really bad. Like the kids will get this paradoxical reaction where they're just more active. Valium tends to have a slower onset. So rather than an on-off switch, it's more like a dimmer. And so personally, I like Valium. I think the combo Valium, morphine, and hydroxyzine is a good combo. There was a lot of literature that came out recently about Presidex as a kind of a replacement for chloral hydrate. And there's literature, a lot of it's out of Virginia, VCU, or Bon Secours, that says Presidex is good. What we found, and we started using it, is the kids were asleep, they were totally calm, until you had to do something. And the minute you had to do something, they were stimulated. So Presidex in the medical world is used a lot in MRIs. And in MRIs, those kids are just not being stimulated. They're basically just lying there during the imaging. So me and my residents all kind of just really did not like Presidex. But that's one of these agents that we start seeing used more often.
Yeah. I've seen a couple things in, you know, we do some intranasal if we've got a kid that's maybe really young or not cooperative, won't take any pre-med in certain special needs a lot of times, like an autistic kiddo. And we don't do it in our office, but I know some guys will mix like do a 1-2 combo of like Versed and put some Presidex intranasally, which I haven't seen
and
done.
That,
but
that's
I guess
what we did. That's what we did.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I don't know if I just we weren't doing it correctly. We just didn't have great outcomes. And I think the other thing that this speaks to is every single person has a different criteria for success. Mm-hmm. Like, what is a successful sedation? And so very often when I'm teaching residents, I'm telling them, like, I don't want you to do something or say something is successful because I think it is. I want you to develop your own measure of success. So I have some residents who want the kid absolutely still, not moving, completely still. And I have others who are like, if the kid's whining and the kid's kind of just vocalizing but not like fighting, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. So I think that also goes back to like what practitioners, private practitioners tend to be more experienced with the restorative part. So doing a crown literally may take you guys like 10 minutes. So you know your limits. And I think the reason that a lot of practitioners use sedation successfully is they match their clinical skills to what they're giving.
That makes sense. What, I was going to touch on chloral hydrate too, because I believe when I listened to Steve Wilson at that lecture, yeah, he was a big chloral hydrate fan. Have you guys used that? Or I know with the big problem, because everybody you talk to that has it says, yeah, it works great, but it sounds like it's an access to the drug. There's no reversal, yes, to it, obviously. But have you had a lot of experience with that one?
So I have a lot of experience just because I trained with Steve, and I completely appreciate Steve's perspective is that he would use a very low dose of chloral hydrate and you would get a really good sedation. So I think one access, as far as it commercially is not being produced, so you have to use a compounding pharmacy. And I think the other issue that I have heard from a private practitioner perspective is the liability of doing something that is potentially a deep sedative in your office. So different states will classify agents differently. So I think for some, there is, hold on, sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. It's when it's always like a dog comes in or the commercial, yeah, comes on, the cleaning lady turns a vacuum cleaner on. So it happens. You're
so
good.
I think, and I'm sorry. So for other folks, the liability of taking an agent that has no reversal and that can get kids pretty deep is scary. And, mm-hmm, you know, if I have something go wrong, I can call a code team. They're there in 2 minutes. Private practitioners don't have that luxury. You call EMS and it varies from state to state, city to city, how long it takes EMS to get to you. So I think that that is scary. So I think practitioners want agents that are more in the minimal to moderate sedation and that are reversible because they're looking at it from a safety perspective. So as much as I may like chloral hydrate, the truth is it's day is done. I think you may see very few locations. Out in Washington, University of Washington and University of North Carolina, where it might have been some of the last areas to really use chloral hydrate. And again, with the advent of more access for in-office general anesthesia, I think that has changed. Yeah. And the other, yeah, thing overlying all of this is, sedations in the literature are reported to be 60 to 70% successful. So if I'm a practitioner, why would I do something that is 60 to 70% successful when I could go to GA, which is 100% successful, you know, if I'm doing a lot of work like that? I think, mm-hmm, it's different if you're doing like a couple of crowns or something where, again, you could use a Versed or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up with a second question. Let's say one of your residents comes up to you and says, "Hey, Dr. Bobby, like I'm, you know, they're graduate. Say they're going to graduate here. you know, in 5 months, and they're going to maybe go could do something crazy, go start their own practice, and they want to take some of your oral sedation techniques and start a practice. So, you know, as you alluded, you know, you didn't have the private practice experience, but being like, you're really on top of the sedation stuff, like what kind of general advice, tips, slash, how would you set it up if you were helping, if you went out to this residence, like new build, and you were going to help kind of construct like a good office layout that, that lent itself well to sedations, I guess, as far as like how many rooms, how many staff, how would you time it? Like, this is kind of how I would go about it if I was setting up a clinic and wanted to offer them in a new private practice setting.
Yeah. And you hit on really, I mean, really critical points, which I think is, one, I would tell all graduates that even if you're not planning on doing oral, any sedation, get your permit and just have it. Have it in your back pocket, because if you decide you want it 3 years down the line, you're going to have to go through a whole bunch of CE and all of this. Secondly, you hit on it, staff. And if you look at what's being regulated, staff training is really, really a hot button item. So The question is, should we have staff that have PALs? PALs is really difficult for dental assistants to go through. So there are some alternatives like PAERS, P-E-A-R-S, which is a lot more clinical, doesn't do cardiac rhythm strips or anything, focuses on airway recognition of airway problems and rescue. But I think your staff have to be, you've got to invest in your staff. So if you are going to do sedations and you're going to bring staff on, you've got to invest them. You know, the AAPD, there are other groups. We do have courses for assistants. And I think those kind of things are good because it sets some parameters. As far as the rooms, I think you could have any setup. You could have a one chair office and you could do sedations, but you cannot overwhelm yourself. So I tell folks, you shouldn't be doing three columns of hygiene plus an oral sedation. During that time that you do sedation, might be a good time to have your hygienist do the scaling, root planing, or Cavitron on our teenagers and things where you may not need to come in and do a check, but they can still be a little independent. I think the other thing about staff is, if a medical emergency happens, there's a chance it's going to happen to you as the dentist. And if you're the only one who knows where everything is and knows how to do this, that's really not going to lead to a good outcome. So I think investing in your staff is huge. And I guess I would say paying them appropriately. Like, if you invest in them, that they're going to help you with sedations and they're going to do all this, I think investing in them financially is also important.
I was, I shadowed there's two guys that are dental anesthesiologists in St. Louis, and they've kind of built the clinic that's like the go-to sedation dental clinic when all else fails and it's a special needs kid, or if it's too old or whatever, it's a payment thing. They're like the go-to, and they're very expensive, but I went and shadowed, and they're doing all the dentistry. And this is a lot of like older special needs adults that, You know, maybe the parents pay like $15,000 for, you know, they'll get three root canals and four crowns And 12 fillings and like four, you know, but they're doing all the anesthesia and all the work. I bring this up because when I went and shadowed them, this was maybe a year ago, I was impressed at how highly trained those guys, you know, you could tell, to your point, they had spent a lot of time, a lot of money. I mean, these assistants knew how to, you know, chart and monitor vitals, and they were just, I was really impressed at what they could do. And I could tell they were highly trained, and I could tell that they were highly compensated. So I think that was a good thing that you brought up. So yeah, we said license, staff training. This is an oddball one, I thought, and I don't mean to input this and hijack this, but one thing that I glad that I did when I built my office out was centrally plumbing oxygen. I feel like if you're thinking about doing sedation
work, you're absolutely versus tanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Because I almost made that mistake. I'm so glad I just paid the extra money to have it just centrally plumbed in so I can keep the Ambu bag, like bag valve mask, all hooked up in its plastic. I can reach over and grab it at any time if I need to, which is really nice.
And I think you hit on a really good point, which is if you're going to make procedural sedation part of your office like routine, then I think those additional expenses ultimately will pay off. And that's where I would hate. So as an example, like what you were just saying, okay, well, let's say you just said, well, no, it's too much. I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to use the little tanks. I mean, I would not be surprised, and there's no evidence I have. I'm just saying this off the top of my head. You're probably more likely to have an issue with tanks than centrally plumbed O2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just think you're right that if you're going to do this and you're going to charge families, like do it right, you know, like, and kind of, I think what you were talking about, shadowing people, looking at successful models, I think that's really important because don't reinvent the wheel. I mean, there are good models out there and you can go look at those, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of, I was joking, you know, there's a lot of other pediatric dentists that are a lot better and smarter that have been doing this a long time. So it's like, you just go shadow good people that know what they're doing, you know?
I have built my career off of listening to those people who are better and smarter than me. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, why try to reinvent the wheel? Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bobby, I'm gonna start tying this together just so it's late on your time. It's late on my time, and I just to kind of wrap things up here. I was gonna end things out just see if you had any closing thoughts or any final words of wisdom to some young residents that maybe want to do some oral sedation, and then as you close out, I might just have you leave some contact info if somebody wants to know when you're speaking again or get a hold of you, all that good stuff.
Sure. You know, I guess I would say one of the things that I do, and I say this all the time, is even after all these years and however many thousands of sedations I've covered or done myself, when I do sedation, I am still nervous. I still go in realizing something could go wrong. And in my head, I'm very often like obsessively repeating to myself, okay, if we lose an airway, what am I going to do? Where's this? Where's that? So when I'm covering residents, I am still very much aware that something could go very wrong. So like I said, I am still nervous when I do sedations and I still run through things that can go wrong so that I'm ready and prepared. And I was thinking of, there's this dentist who practiced in Florida. And she had done like over 30,000 sedations without issue. And she was probably 6 months from retirement and she had a death in her office.
No.
And so all that previous 30,000 is just like negated because of this horrible event. So I never take for granted that something could go wrong. And I think my closeout message is, doesn't matter how experienced you are, how capable you are, how intelligent you are, getting too confident can really lead to poor outcomes. So I still respect very much that I'm giving a young child a medication and I'm not sure exactly what I'm gonna get.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, the first thought that came to mind when you said that was a podcast a couple guys I listened to that were in the military say that's a common thing in wartime. It's like there's a term for it, but when you know that you're going home that day or two before, your bags are packed. That's when guys get killed because they drop their guard. That, you know, so it's like it's when you get too comfortable and you think everything's good where you get into a
absolutely.
Pickle.
Absolutely, that's totally it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Bobby, where can people hear you speak and how can people get a hold of you, you know, if they want to hit you up with some questions?
Sure. So my email is SARAT thikkurissy@cchmc.org. As far as where I'm speaking, I speak at a lot of state dental societies. I'm going to be in Texas in September. I'm going to be in Maryland coming up. And then usually every year we do the AAPD sedation course. So I now run that course for the AAPD, and that is typically in October. So that will be there as well.
That sounds good. Where is it at this year?
Los Angeles. So it's going to be West Coast.
Very cool. Very cool.
So come out to La La.
I'm glad we finally got to, we've been trying to make this podcast happen for several months now. I'm really glad we finally got to, you know, make it happen. And I enjoyed our conversation tonight. So thank you for taking the time to carve out a little time in your night and chat.
Yeah. Thank you. And I appreciate what you, bring to all the dentists out there. Cause I think your podcast, you know, I was, once we talked, I was looking back on, and I listened to some of the other episodes, and I think there's really good information out there. So, I appreciate what you do.
Absolutely. Bobby, have a good night. Cheers. Thanks for having a drink with me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Bruise and Tiny Teeth podcast. Be sure to DM our host, Casey Getz, on social media with any listener questions, comments, or tough clinical situations. We'll see you next week for another unfiltered episode.